Welcome to Lessons from a PhD, where every single episode teaches you different lessons to make your PhD and career journey easier. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Lessons from a PhD. My name is Dr. Anna A.O., and I am your host. So today, I am joined by a very special guest, my dear friend, Dr. Nyasha Gandora. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Anna. So excited for our conversation.
Yes, I am super excited too. But before we dive into it, let me introduce you to the audience because I want everyone to know how amazing you are, okay? So Dr. Nyasha Gandora was born and raised in Zimbabwe, where she developed a passion for science through observing the impact of science and medicine in her community. After earning a bachelor in biochemistry and molecular biology at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, Nyasha completed a PhD in neuropharmacology at the University of Waterloo in Canada, where she was the first Black PhD graduate of the program. I'm just going to pause there and give you a hand clap because that is a huge accomplishment. Congrats on that. With over 10 years of experience in the life sciences and a track record that spans consulting and government, she brings a rare intersectional perspective to every space she enters. Driven by a deep passion for representation and empowerment, Nyasha has held leadership roles in national and international organizations, championing equity and excellence wherever she goes. And in 2024, she was recognized as one of Canada's top 100 Black women to watch. So Nyasha, again, welcome so much to the podcast. And let's dive into this very interesting conversation.
Fantastic.
Awesome. So whenever I have a guest, I always like to first start off by telling the audience how we met, because I think it's really cool how I meet different people in my walks of life. And I'm sure it's cool how you meet different people in your walks of life too. And sometimes it's just very random. And I think that our first interaction was also very random. So maybe I'll start it off and you can chime in if I miss anything, okay?
That sounds great.
All right. So Dr. Nyasha and I met through a mutual group that we are part of called the Black Wealth Club. And we'll talk a little bit about that group later in the interview. But I remember I was on LinkedIn randomly and I saw a message from someone called Nyasha, which was you. And I opened it and it was just a really nice letter saying like, oh, I saw that you're also part of the Black Wealth Club. And you also have a PhD in science, which I thought was really cool because I know that when I joined the Black Wealth Club, there were a lot of people that were very, very accomplished, but no one was in science. So I always felt like the only scientist there. And I was just like, oh, is there anyone else that's interested in like pharmaceuticals or science? So it was really great that you hit me up. So I don't know if you want to add anything to that story.
Yes, I was so excited, Anna, when I said, oh my gosh, there's another scientist here. And I thought, you should grab coffee. I'd like to learn about Anna's journey, her story. And I was so delighted. You know, like, yes, let's meet up. And the rest is history.
Yes, exactly. The rest is history. So like you said, we did meet for coffee initially. And we kind of talked both about our experiences during our PhD. And I remember when I was talking to you and I was hearing your experience, I was like, wow, a lot of the things that you encountered, all of the challenges you encountered, the things that you faced, I also went through the same thing as well. And there was a lot of synergy in our stories. So maybe let's share that with the audience. I know the audience has already heard my PhD story, so we're not even going to talk about me. But this interview is all about you. And so I want to kind of dive into just your PhD journey. So maybe if you take us back even before your PhD, and talk about what got you interested in academia, in science, and maybe we can start from there.
Absolutely. I think I'll start with my undergrad experience. So I was studying biochemistry and molecular biology at Trinity University in Texas. And one thing that really drew me, like in my classes, was would learn all these scientific, you know, facts and whatnot, but it's really when we will be walked through the different experiments that led to the discoveries that now, you know, govern what we know and how these different mechanisms work. That's what really got me. And I thought, okay, here we are reading about what people did. And hey, maybe I could be a part of contributing to the literature, being part of contributing to what the world knows about how cells work, or, you know, so that's really what got me into it. So I started volunteering in various research labs during my undergraduate studies, just to gain that experience, to gain that exposure. And with time, as I was nearing the end of my studies, I was thinking to my next steps, you know, what am I going to do? Where am I going to go? And first of all, as I'm thinking of doing a PhD, I thought, okay, let me go do my master's. So that's what I applied for and got into the program at the University of Waterloo. And it was a neuropharmacology lab under Dr. Mike Beasley. And I was also co-supervised by Dr. John Mulcair at the School of Public Health and Health Systems. So quite a bit of diversity there. So after starting, you know, in the lab at Waterloo, I think at first there was just a lot of excitement, you know, having, you know, achieved my goal, I'm there. I started my program. But there was a lot of, you know, transition that, you know, lay ahead for me. I had done more biochem, molecular biology. This was more of a neuroscience lab. So there was a lot of learning that had to happen, a lot of, you know, shifting gears. And I think that's true for anyone who starts, you know, a program, that sense of learning and, you know, needing to deliver. So fast forward, I think my first year in the bed, I realized, okay, I'm actually enjoying this. Let's see if, you know, I can stay longer. So at Waterloo, they have what they call fast tracking, where you can transfer into a PhD program straight from a master's program without completing a master's. So I fast tracked from the master's to the PhD program. And I think that's where, you know, the longer term journey began. And I'd say it was a journey that kind of like a rose, you know, has the beauty to it, but they also the thorns. And anyone who's been in the lab can attest to, you know, having that excitement, that honor of, okay, I'm doing something novel. I'm asking questions that no one has asked before. But there's a thorn, often the challenges you run into. And when you run into these challenges, there's no textbook to read and say, okay, let me see what I need to do right, right? Because this is often new methodology. You're trying to basically go into uncharted land. So in my journey, I learned a lot as it relates to resilience. Learning to say, okay, I'm coming across XYZ challenges. How do I overcome them and keep going, right? And with that came, you know, the skill to problem solve, as, you know, you're troubleshooting, trying to figure out what you can work on, what you can improve. And I think this journey as well is something that taught me a lot about leadership, because, you know, in your PhD, you really have to take ownership of your program. You do have supervisors who walk alongside you, but it's your project. And, you know, you have to be able to demonstrate the capacity to think ahead, okay, this is working well, let me do that. Okay, this is not working well, so I think things like to do this. There is support from the supervisors, but there's that sense of having to, or being able to stand alone. And I think lastly, what I learned was just, you know, learning to communicate. Often, you know, we had committee meetings here at various milestones. You had to present your work, your progress, what's going well, what the challenges are. Not only just presenting it, but providing rationale. So I think those are all skills that I really gained through that process. And as I highlighted, there was just a lot of, you know, things that I enjoyed about the process. But as well, there were also some challenges which turned into like major lessons. So that's been my journey. Well, that was my journey.
Yeah, no, I love how you focused on the different skills that you learned during your PhD, because you said that you mentioned that you learned different problem solving and troubleshooting. And I remember I spoke about that a lot too, because that is pretty much your whole degree is troubleshooting, because everything goes wrong. Like nothing goes right during your experiments. So I can definitely relate to that. But I want to kind of rewind, because you did say that from your bachelor's, you went into a master's, right? And the one thing that I find about graduate school and graduate programs is that they're so specific, whereas in undergrad, the programs are so general. So in undergrad, you'll find you'll go into an undergrad in chemistry or even biomedical science or biopharmaceutical science. And it's just so general. And then within that program, you'll have different courses, I guess I can say, but even still those courses are super general, right? So how did you choose neuropharmacology? Because that is a very specific field. And so what kind of sparked your interest in neuropharmacology from a bachelor in molecular bio?
So love that. That's a great question. The real story actually goes back to my third year, where I was starting to look to the future and thinking, okay, I am studying biochemistry and molecular biology. You know, do I want to continue either within biochemistry or molecular biology? And really, what impact am I trying to have? And for me, my heart leans towards being able to use those skills, but within a place where I felt I'll be able to make impact more on a human population level versus, oh, the cells are doing this, that's fantastic, but more so, okay, how can that be applied to help in some way? So I was home visiting my parents in Zimbabwe. My father's a pharmacist, and he had this massive bookshelf just with a lot of pharmacology books. And I was just wandering around and, you know, looking through the bookshelf and just starting to look through some books and realizing, hey, this is a whole lot of biochemistry here. A lot of things that really align with the molecular biology I was learning, and all of this coming together more so in pharmacology. So I think that's what initially led me to, maybe I could consider pharmacology, because it is still science, but science as it relates to having that impact on human health and outcomes. Mm-hmm. So that's what led me in that direction. And as I was looking for opportunities, I was in the years of that time, I really thinking, okay, do I look for grad schools here? Which I did look for some grad schools there. I started exploring, you know, Canada as well as the neighbor to the north. You know, loved some of the programs that I came across. And when I came across my, you know, supervisor's lab, I was just so intrigued by the research they were doing there and just the bigger picture implications, you know, looking at how pharmacology of the brain, understanding how different factors can impact that. I was specifically studying stress, and I was like, hold up, life is full of stress. And we're looking at pharmacology, which kind of connects with biochemistry and molecular biology. I was like, this is the perfect marriage of relevance in terms of my skill set and the world I live in. Let's go. So long winding story, but that's the nutshell of how I ended up going from BCMB to neuropharmacology.
And I think that's so interesting, and that's so good that you were looking at what you were interested in, you know, because a master's and even a PhD is a long-term commitment. And with all the challenges that you face, I remember my friend and I, when we were doing our PhD together, we would always say that, thank God we're actually interested in what we are researching, because with all these trials and things that you're trying to troubleshoot, it's the interest that drives you. You know, it's the curiosity that drives you. And like you said, you wanted something that was applicable to everyday life and to humans and to people in general. So I think that's really important when choosing a PhD program or even a master's program as well. And so when you pivoted from master's to your PhD, did you see much similarities, or was it a huge stepping stone in your eyes?
So that's a great question, Anna. So the main difference I found between my master's and when I transferred into the PhD program was just the difference of scope in terms of, you know, the amount of data that would have been sufficient to complete my master's versus that which was required for my PhD. And as well, in my PhD, there was also an element of, you know, mentorship that came into play, as, you know, I now had to support, not had to, have the privilege of supporting and working with, you know, new students in the lab, whether they were master's level, you know, fellow PhDs, helping with that, you know, training aspect. And I think also the level of independence that was required, there was just a slight shift in expectation there that, okay, you should be able to be more of an independent researcher. So if you have a problem, instead of going to your supervisor, oh, XYZ, do the research, look up what you can, come and propose, hey, I have run into this hurdle, but based on the research, I think I could do ABC. What are your thoughts? More for conversation rather than tell me what to do. So those are the major differences that I found between the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I always feel like master's is more like you're being babied a little. And then a PhD is more like, okay, you can fly now. You're on your own.
On your own.
Yeah, go and venture out. So yeah, I also found a huge difference just in terms of responsibility. I guess going into your master's and even your PhD, did you know what you wanted to do in the end? Did you have an end goal in mind, or did that kind of come afterwards?
That's a great question. I entered into my graduate studies just with an open-mindedness in that I knew that I wanted to make impact within the field of health and felt that pursuing graduate studies would be a tool, you know, that would enable me to have the skills to serve in one of the different types of industries. So I entered with more of an open-minded approach to it and really sought to develop skills broadly, even after my PhD, that would allow me able to boast the skill set that I felt would enable me to work at the level that I wanted to.
I really like that. I don't think I've actually heard that before, people entering into a PhD with an open mindset. Usually it's more like you have an end goal in mind where you want to go into academia, become a professor, or you want to, you know, do whatever. But having an open mindset, I think, is really good. So nearing the end of your PhD, how did that transition work? Because you didn't go directly into the job market. You went and did, I think, a couple postdocs, if I remember correctly. So how did you navigate that transition?
So in the end of my PhD, I think one thing that I realized was I really enjoyed the research, but, you know, the wet lab research was perhaps not where I saw myself long term. So I wanted to explore where else can I make impact in terms of, okay, there are questions to be answered that can really tangibly impact the community, but it's not requiring me to be in the lab for 12 hours. I'm a bit of an extrovert, so I also wanted, you know, the kind of projects that would put me within teams where there's engagement, collaborative, you know, problem solving. So my first postdoc actually transitioned me into a more clinical team. Once again, it was at the University of Portuguese School of Pharmacy. And as a postdoc, my project was to support the development of an opioid de-prescribing guideline for seniors. So within the context of this project, I had to recruit various subject matter experts across the country, physicians, pharmacists, nurses, some academics as well, and was also working with some support from the core team, including, you know, some undergraduate or PharmD volunteers. So it really placed me in a place where I felt, okay, I want to transition more into the more near impact. And what I mean by that is often when you're in the lab, you can be doing a project that may potentially, and I emphasize potentially, 20 to 30 years down the line, lead to a discovery that could lead to a drug, that could lead to, that's in the best case scenario. But often, you know, you're doing amazing work that can be the building block for further amazing work and further amazing work, which one day may lead to a discovery, right? Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to be a part of something that I thought like was closer to impact, but also in terms of the type of problem solving allowed a more collaborative approach. So I think that was my first postdoc. A lot of learning, mm-hmm. really amazing. I was really grateful for that opportunity. Mm-hmm. I was in that role for about 2 years. And then after that, I took wind of an opportunity at the University of Toronto through the Ontario Health Team Fellowship. Really clear there was embedded fellows at various OHT, Ontario Health Teams, across the province, where in a sense you would serve as, for lack of a better word, a consultant, where you would support that health team in achieving specific goals that they had, be it an evaluation, be it in performance measurement, or whatever that was. So that second experience, which was shorter than the first, really gave me a greater understanding of health systems at the provincial level. And then after that, my third and final postdoc was the MITAC Science Policy Fellowship, which we took scientists from across the country and embedded them within various departmental agencies in government and taught and trained them in policy. So it's almost like them being equipped with that science policy perspective. So it was me then transitioning from having that provincial knowledge to now the federal and all the, not all of the policies, but just the policy landscape as it applies to science for policy and what they call policy for science. Mm. So it was an amazing experience. And as you can tell from my journey, started in the lab, worked with that preclinical work, specialist, drug development, transitioning to more clinical work that was at the cusp of, human impact through a clinical guideline, and then getting that provincial and then that federal exposure within that science scope. So overall, that was my journey and how I navigated transition to build and to develop the skill set.
Wow, that's a very, very interesting and unique journey, I would definitely say. And especially because you did it all through postdocs, which is quite interesting. Because usually people will just jump into the industry and kind of like work their way and navigate through. But you took the opportunity and you did it all through postdoc fellowships, which I think is really great. Because the one thing that I find that's nice about a postdoc, it's a great transitional work, right? So if you want to maybe transition to another field, because that's kind of what I use to transition into the field that I'm in right now, right? Is I used a postdoc to do so, because it's still, I would say, more of a learning opportunity, but it's also at the same time, it's a job too. So it's not like you're a student again, you are working, but it's still looked at as, I would say, a learning opportunity. So that's really cool how you transition from wet lab work, preclinical, to clinical, to government, and then you found yourself in the federal government, which is
after that last year.
Yeah, which is so that last.
So the thing is that last fellowship actually then led me into a role within the federal government.
Mm-hmm. And so I want to talk about your federal government role, because I remember when you first contacted me and I searched you up on LinkedIn. And I saw that you were working with the federal government in clinical trials. That was very interesting to me, because I was like, I don't think I know anyone who is working directly with the federal government in that capacity and also working with clinical trials. So maybe if you can talk a little bit about that and your role and what exactly you did.
Absolutely. So I worked at the Canadian Institute of Health Research, and that is a federal funding agency that is the largest health research funder within the Canadian context. So one of the things that happened post-COVID was that there was that realization that, okay, maybe there's a bit of work to be done in terms of our clinical trials ecosystem. So they launched a new team within CIHR, which I was then recruited into. And essentially what we did is that, we supported the development of funding opportunities, we supported the development of policies, as well as performance measurement for CIHR funded clinical trials. So to be clear, the organization did fund clinical trials before, but this new team was more so to become the hub of all clinical trial funding and also engagement with researchers across the nation to try to understand some of those challenges as it relates to, clinical trials, how, they can be further support for those federally funded trials. So overall, it was just a phenomenal experience for me. I had been the researcher and now working in a research funding agency on the other side of things, I think it was really eye-opening. And once again, it was a full circle moment. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's amazing. So aside from that, you currently sit on two boards for two different organizations. Now, what led you to pursue those leadership roles? And how do those organizations align with your purpose and values?
So that's a question that's near and dear to my heart. I think what really drew me to these organizations is primarily the alignment in terms of, you know, their mission and vision and, you know, what is my passion. So one of my greatest passions is to empower people, help them achieve their goals, help them, you know, achieve their dreams. And, you know, the first organization that a board member with, Boy with a Ball, is headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia, but has offices in North and South America, in Africa, and the Middle East. And what they do, they work in underserved communities, really reaching out to the youth through various educational and engagement programs to keep them off the streets, really those high-risk youth, to help channel their potential towards a productive means and an end. So it's an organization I've known about for many years. And in fact, a lot of people in my network had been quite heavily involved with. So I was always a supporter of their mission and their vision. So when I was invited to join the board, for me, it was a real pleasure to support that. Myself having been, I'm from Zimbabwe, and really understanding what it's like to be, you know, a young person, really understanding sometimes, you know, the challenges that can exist in various contexts and how you need people to come alongside you and support your dreams and allow you to focus on the bigger picture. For me, that support was my immediate family, you know, my parents, you know, the community around us, where, you know, we were championed, you know, pushed to dream bigger and, you know, to push for more. But I always think, you know, imagine those who maybe don't have that support at home, that don't have that immediate network. So I think that's where the passion and the alignment was with that first organization. And with the second organization, Advancing Black Talent in Pharma, their mission is really to increase representation of, you know, the Black community within the life sciences and pharmaceutical space. And I joined their board as a director of partnership development, mainly because I have been the one and the only in a lot of spaces. As you mentioned earlier, I was the first Black PhD graduate at the University of Waterloo in my specific program. So really understanding that journey of being the one and the only, you understand the value of representation and the support that people can need. So once again, it came from a place of passion. So I think overall, to summarize my answer, looking at the board that I've joined, there really is strong alignment with my own personal passion and really seeking, you know, the opportunity to advance their mission and their goals as organizations, because I believe in what's being done. And in terms of, you know, the skills, you know, the capacity that I had to develop to excel in these places, these will be skills that I would have developed, you know, over the course of, you know, life. Sometimes, you know, education, as we spoke about earlier, you know, in the PhD, learning how to communicate, learning not only just to say what you've done, but why. So often on a board, it's like, you know, if you're giving a recommendation, you have to be evidence-based. So learning how to be able to pull on relevant information to provide evidence-based information. Also considering who is the target, right? What's the question? What's the motive? What are we trying to achieve? How can I communicate this effectively to that specific audience? Mm-hmm. So once again, not just communication in terms of this is why you should do it and why, but learning to frame it in a way that is most acceptable to the cause and the question at hand. And I think, you know, learning to be confident in one's convictions, one's thoughts, one's views, sharing that. And I think the last skill I would say is the capacity to work with and engage with others, because on a board, you're not alone. It's not the Nyasha show. It's teamwork. So it's really learning to engage with others, work with different personalities, learn to do so under pressure, sometimes under significant time constraints. So overall, those are the main skills I have found to be most impactful, and these are skills I developed over the course of my education and I think also general life experiences.
Yeah, I love that. I love that you're giving back. I think it's so important to do so. And I love that you're doing it with two organizations that resonate, you know, with you and your values. So I love to hear that. And like you touched on again is skills. And I love talking about transferable skills because, you know, I find that a lot of us PhDs, we did, and I won't speak for all of us PhDs, but most of us, especially us in the sciences, we did a lot of bench work in our PhD, a lot of developmenting experiments and just very niche things when it comes to science. But then when it comes to the job market, a lot of times if you don't go directly into academia, there aren't a lot of jobs that will have those technical skills or that will allow us to use those technical skills that we learn in the lab, which doesn't mean that we put our PhD to waste because there are so many other non-technical skills that we learned along the way. And you touched on so many of them. And I think that's very, very important for someone who is currently doing their PhD right now to know that even if they don't end up in their field that they're pursuing right now, it doesn't mean that their PhD was a waste because there are so many skills along the way that just unknowingly that you pick up that can be used in so many different capacities. I mean, look at you, you're using those skills to be a board member, right? So who would have thought that some of this,
honestly, who would have thought?
Yeah, some of the skills that you learned in your PhD would be put to use as a board member. So thank you so much for touching on that as well.
Not at all. Just to really second what you're saying, every skill you gain, you know, even in the lab, budgeting, oh goodness, you know, you need to purchase this, and this is going to last that long. Mm-hmm. There will be a time in the future you may need to budget, be it resources or funds, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so all this to say, be it communication, be it planning, all the little things that you often consider small when you're a PhD student, I just have to do that. Everything has value and everything is transferable to so many different types of roles. So just to really echo what you're saying, even if you don't end up within that field, you have skills, you have tools through your training that can take you anywhere as doors open.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So aside from all the wonderful work that you've done, all the positions that you've held, last year, you were also named Canada's top 100 Black women to watch in the whole of Canada. That is a huge accomplishment. When I saw that, I was like, yeah, that's my friend. That is a huge, huge accomplishment. Congratulations. So what did that recognition mean to you personally?
That's a loaded question. And for me, I think it brought a lot to mind. I was really humbled because when I look back at my journey, I'm not sure if others can relate to this, but you know, imposter syndrome, sometimes when you're in places and spaces, like, do I belong here? Am I going to make it? And, you know, I think one of the first things that came to mind was thinking of all those people, my support network who stood by the door. What I mean by stood by the doors, when I wanted to quit and say, nah, I think I'm in the wrong place, people said, no, you got this, you believe in, you finish what you started. And I get to say, oh, you know, I made it. But it's so easy to say, I made it and emphasize I and forget all the people who were with you along the journey. So I think for me, it was just a moment of reflection and being like, oh my goodness, I had a village, an entire community standing with me at various times. And I think the outcomes would have been so different did I not have that support. And I think also for often different organizations who, you know, I've had the privilege of working with and realizing, hey, for some of them, I came with, okay, here's a resume, this is what I can offer. But, you know, in my earlier days, I was like, hey, I'm so passionate. If you give me a chance, I promise I'll do something new. So realizing that, hey, you know, the people who had to look at them like, okay, sure, give you a chance, we believe in you, you know. And I think also I just really reflected on my early years.
Humble beginnings.
Sorry, I'm not going to get emotional. Yeah. But I was always one of those kids who's like, oh my God, you know, this full of dreams, full of, you know, and I just go back to my parents. You know how, you know, when you get older, the reality of life and what it can be, it's so easy to crush young kids' dreams, you know, but my parents didn't do that. It's like, I'll see sometimes the most ridiculous things that one day I'm going to be this, my child, you can do this, mom, one day. And, you know, I think for me, it Yes, you know, life can be hard. Yes, the world can be full of, you know, challenges and whatnot. But I think at that young age, what that taught me was just the freedom to dream, the freedom to shoot your shot without the fear that maybe this isn't for me, without even trying, you know. So I think that was something that was really profound as I was just dwelling and reflecting and thinking, man, this could have been killed in my childhood if someone told me, you can't do that. Who like who looks like you who seen do that? But instead I just had people who just, you know, with the wind in my sails, were like, oh, trust God, you can do anything. That's a nice dream, my child. You know, one day, you know. So I think what that has challenged me to do is often now as an adult, when I want to clip my own wings, like, oh God, you don't belong here. Like, I don't think you can do this. I'm challenged to ask myself, like, who told you that? What happened to that little kid who was, you know? So all of this to say, and I think this for me, this acknowledgement was really humbling for me. It made me think of my community, those who supported me, made me think of just, you know, all the amazing work that I've had the opportunity to partner with because people opened the doors for me to partner with them in it. So that's what this award meant to me.
Wow, that's so beautiful. And I love how you brought it back to your parents too, and how your parents always just allowed you to dream big, you know, and I think that's so important. And so would you say that who you are today was shaped by your upbringing?
100%, 100%. And not to say that everything was always perfect in my journey. I had hurdles, I had a lot of challenges, but I think even how I was supported in that was very, so I'll give an example. So as a kid, one thing I always said was, oh my gosh, you know, I want to study in the US on scholarship, right? And I don't know what the on scholarship part was for about me, but maybe it's just that sense of, oh, I earned it, or oh, the recognition. Listen, I need to sit and dig into my young soul to figure out what that was about. But that was my big dream. And I remember at the end of high school applying to a bunch of schools, and Canada was rejection after rejection after rejection after rejection for quite a number. And, you know, I just remember my parents like saying, God is faithful. You've got me. You know, let's just keep applying, you know, and just learning this mindset that, you know, you don't need 1,000 yeses, you need one. So when there are closed doors in your face, when there are challenges, it's not a matter of saying, oh, maybe let me change my dream. But it's really assessing, okay, if I believe I'm aligned, if I believe I have what it takes, if I've done everything I can to be aligned with this, then where can I align myself to find that opportunity? In other words, you know, can I keep going? Can I keep pushing? And for me, it was, I think, the seventh or the eighth school that accepted me with almost $100,000 in scholarship, you know. But I had to go through, you know, a couple of weeks of tears and, oh my gosh. But, you know, no one said, see, you're being so ridiculous, you can't do this. It was just a sense of, you know, keep pushing. And, you know, my parents are people of such strong faith. I'm like, it's okay, you know, keep pushing, keep, you know, so. I think for me to support not only in the floweriness of my youthful dreams, but even when I faced hurdles to those dreams, just how I was met by support and we still believe in you, keep pushing, let's see what happens. It's not the end. And in summary, I think overall, yes, that was just one example of what their support meant to me very practically. But yes, 100%, I'd say my upbringing, I was not taught to see limitations. And even when faced by limitations, it's like you need one open door, not 20, just one.
Just one.
So I credited my parents for all their support and even their continued support, even today.
Yeah.
They're still spurring me on in those moments of self-doubt. They're
Wow.
like, oh, child, you can do this.
Wow. That's so amazing. And I think it's so important to speak life into your situation, you know, and even if, you know, people are listening and their parents aren't there supporting them, I think it's so important even for yourself to speak life into your situation. Because I don't think people understand, it's not like you were in the US looking for schools to attend and get a scholarship. You were in Zimbabwe, in Africa, a small country in Africa where no one knows you. And you have a dream to go to the US, not even to pay for school, but on a scholarship. That is a huge dream. That is a huge dream for someone coming internationally with all the competition out there as well.
A lot,
A lot of
a lot.
competition. So the fact that you were able to get scholarships over $100,000, and so does that mean that
Almost,
almost,
not over, almost a hundred
almost,
thousand.
okay, sorry.
Yes, 97,000 to be exact.
even that is so above anyone that like that is so above anyone that or sorry, that is so above a lot of people's accomplishments, you know? And so I think that speaks to you speaking life to yourself and to your situation, and also your parents cheering you on in the background. And I also owe that to faith as well, and your faith in God. And that's something that we also connected over when we met too, is how we're both Christians, we're both believers, and faith just really brought us through our PhD journey. And even just looking at both of our lives and seeing how God has just worked everything out for good, all the challenges, all the trials, all the
There
tribulations.
have been many.
Yeah, there have been many, but we stand here saying that, like, we look back in hindsight and we're like, yes, we know that God was in our situation, right? So how has your Christian faith specifically shaped your career path and the decisions that you've made in the past, especially during those uncertain transitions where you're like, I don't really know if this is the right step, but I'm just gonna take a step of faith and see how everything's gonna work out.
Oh my goodness. When you talk about transitions, I feel like I've had a lot of those. Whether it was, leaving Zimbabwe, moving to Texas, I'd never been to Texas. I'd never been to the US. whether it was leaving the US, coming to Canada. I'd also never been to Canada and, hadn't known the context of coming in, whether it's even career transitions, leaving the lab, doing this, doing that. So there really have been a lot of transitions, a lot of gaps, and a lot of moments where I reflected and asked myself, am I doing the right thing? Or maybe a door opened, they're like, ooh, this is harder than I thought. Am I meant to be here? Or did I make the right decision? And I think to me, those are times where I've really seen God support me. And, I think back to Jeremiah 29:11, for I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future. And, that verse alone is amazing. But if you think about it, it was a verse that came from the prophet Jeremiah speaking to the children of Israel, who at that point had been taken into exile in Babylon. So he was not declaring everything's going to work out to people who were living their best life, everything was good. He was declaring this to people who had been taken more or less into quote unquote exile slash slavery, however you look at it, in a different land. So I think the promise of God's faithfulness to me has really been like a light in the darkness in some of those hard times, in those moments of transition. And life is full of transition. Sometimes there's a lot of hardship, and it's those moments often that define, who you become. How do you handle it when things don't go your way? How do you handle when, really literally you cannot control how things are happening around you? And for me, those times I've been anchored in my faith. And also surrounded by a community where I knew, okay, I'm praying for myself. There are people who are praying for me. And sometimes also working in community with others where you get to support others, and that takes the focus off of me, 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 me. So in summary, I think I've seen the goodness of God. I've seen his faithfulness in good times and in bad. And it's often in those tough moments you're like, wow, the light shines brightest in the darkness, right? You can still see a light in the light. You can turn the candle on in the day. You can see it. But turn the lights off, that candle just lights up the room. So I think, God to me has just been that constant light in my life, which I'm thankful for, and I'm grateful for my faith. It's an anchor, and it's a found my foundation.
Yeah, no, I completely I align with everything that you said. I completely agree. So apart from, you being crowned as 100 or the top 100, one of Canada's top 100 Black women to watch, as well as all the positions that you've held, all the accomplishments that you've held as well, you're also part of the Black Wealth Club too, and that's how we met. That's what we said at the beginning of the episode. So if you want to maybe talk a little bit about that community and maybe how that community has influenced your mindset, your network, and the different opportunities that have maybe come your way from that, from the group.
Absolutely. And if I miss anything out as I'm describing the Black Box Club, please feel free to chime in.
Of course.
But really, it's an amazing network and community. And essentially how it works is that every year, they open applications, people apply, and you get accepted into this community of, support. There are a lot of people within this network who are rising leaders within the financial, the tech, the business world. That's the majority of the network, actually. Mm-hmm. And then there also others like Anna and I, who are, scientists, rising stars within the science space. So really what I've loved about this community, it's a community of quote-unquote rising stars.
Yes.
People have such big dreams, such great passions. And even though you see people from fields other than your own, it is so inspiring. And I think it's a place where, I've been challenged often to reevaluate, Nyasha, are you dreaming big enough? Or have you shrunk your dreams to what you think you can accomplish in terms of, or are you really allowing yourself to spread your wings and fly? I remember there was one event, I'm forgetting all the names now, maybe it's a good thing I shouldn't mention names on the podcast in case they don't consent, but people who in venture capital or whatever it is, was it millions of dollars, for various initiatives, startups, launches, and they're like, wow, so I think just being surrounded by great minds, people who are doing big things, people who you're seeing moving leaps and bounds, it inspires you to also do the same. So I think that's what this network has meant to me. And beyond that, there's even the friendships that come out of that. Apart from the professional development side, just the friendships. Like, Anna, you have, been so near and dear to my heart since we met and we connected. And that is through the Black Box Club. And I get inspired by you, by everything that you're achieving within your career, this podcast, even the goals that you have. Often when we sit and chat about those future goals, I'm like, wow, that's amazing, Anna. So I think it's not only just the professional development, but also the friendships and the community. And I think I've mentioned community multiple times in our chat. Who surrounds you is very important. I think what the Black Box Club has done for me is put me in an environment where I'm surrounded by great people. And I keep learning all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And even the speakers they bring, the people who teach, train, coach on different topics, it's just, it opens your mind in ways that sometimes you can't open your own mind for yourself by yourself.
Yes. Yeah.
So
I completely agree with you. Every time I'm in that space, I'm always inspired. Because like you said, it's filled with rising stars. And so it's people that are on the rise. But even looking at what they've accomplished, I'm like, man, like these people are just killing it at life. But I think that the one thing that I love about the Black Wealth Club is the representation part. Because like you said, it really just breaks down the limitations in your mind. Because, we live in a country where it's not common to see a Black face that is wealthy, that is doing successful in their field, that is at the executive level. We don't really come by that every single day. And I'm not saying that they're not there, but it's hidden. If they are there, it's hidden. We don't really have access to them. So I think that the Black Wealth Club also brings access to those people that look like us and are also killing it in their field are executives and are doing very, very well. And it just breaks the limitations in your mind that you can accomplish anything in this country that we're in, in Canada. So I really love being
love
part of it. And I love that I'm not the only scientist there.
Yes, Anna.
Yeah.
I was so happy when I met you. I know we had this conversation offline, but
I was like, no way. There's another scientist.
Right? It's often, you're in a room full of business people.
I know, which is actually great because I feel like I'm not very business minded and I don't really surround myself with that kind of group, right? So it's really nice to hear like different perspectives from people that are more business minded, because I'm so used to people like us like science.
Exactly. And I love that, you know, it really opens your mind in ways you're like, okay, I cannot open my mind in this way because this is not my natural strength. Exactly. So you challenge your stretch. So yes, it's I love that.
I love
that. So hopefully as a scientist, bring that to the table for them as well. Something.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. No, I completely agree. So this has been a really great chat, Nyasha. You've spilled so many nuggets, so many different just life lessons that you've shared with us. And I think that your whole journey is a testimony. I think that you can learn so much from what someone has been through, you know, and from your story and just the little kind of tips and nuggets that you drop. I've been inspired, and I really hope that the audience is inspired when listening to this as well. And so with all of my guests, what I'm doing is, because the podcast name is Lessons from a PhD, and you, Dr. Nyasha, are a PhD holder, I want to ask you, what is some advice that you could give someone who is currently doing their PhD and who may feel stuck or unsure about the future, and even their life beyond academia? What is a lesson that you have learned that you can kind of give back to the audience?
So just a few nuggets to share. Number one, I remember being at a place where I was like, oh my goodness, will I ever finish? Oh my goodness, will I ever make it? And I remember once, you know, opening up to, you know, we had been like, oh, you know, this last little stretch is tough. Like, oh my God, you too. I'm struggling as well. And then the more we talk to people, it's like we just realize, oh my goodness, all of us were just kind of pushing ourselves, really battling with that sense of, will we make it? So I think one thing I'll say is, no, you're not alone. Sometimes when you're walking your day to day and you're just navigating the ups and the downs of, be it if you're in a wet lab-based research project where it's like, you know, the days in the lab, or maybe a different kind of PhD project, whatever it is, know that in those tough times you feel stuck, you're not alone. And in knowing you're not alone, you won't ask yourself, what's wrong with me? Why aren't I finding this easy? Why isn't this smooth sailing? You will know that, okay, this is the journey I'm on, and it's a tough journey, but I've made it this far, and I'm going to finish. And I think of a discussion I once had with someone who was like, if it was so easy, everyone would have a PhD, right? So in those moments when you feel like this is hard, you know, okay, it's not you who's not doing good, it's hard.
Yeah, it's just
and
hard.
And when you can know that this is hard and you're not alone, it gives you that confidence to say, okay, so now how can I step up my boots to handle this? Because I've established I can do this. It's hard, not because there's something wrong with me, but it's hard because it's hard. Mm-hmm. Let me move forward. Let me now build that resilience and that strength. And trust me, as you build that muscle of resilience, that push through the tough times, it's a muscle that will serve you in different times and seasons in life. So it's a transferable skill, I can assure you that. And so in other words, connecting with others and just knowing you've got this, keeping just that positive mindset and outlook. And I'd say also one thing that can remove the pressure is starting to navigate your next steps before you get to the end. Because it can be hard. Let's say you're thinking, oh, let me defend my PhD. Oh, and what am I doing after this? Oh, and but what about this? But when you can engage in some of those discussions in advance, you know, with people where you feel their support, be it, you know, your supervisors or your network, I think that's something that's phenomenal. In my case, I knew I wanted to do a postdoc, but not in the lab. I had to have a frank conversation with my PhD supervisor, who was really supportive of, okay, now let's brainstorm and see how you can navigate that next step, who you can start networking with and connecting with, who I can introduce you to help you with that goal. So I think that's another thing as well. When you start sometimes thinking of the future, you see out of the present moment, but also planning for the future means less pressure near the end. So yeah, those are just some, I'll say two tips off the top of my head that are maybe the most foundational based on my experience that I would like to share with others. And you got this, whoever you are, I'm proud of you. You've come this far. Don't give up. You've got this.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Nyasha. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your experience with us and sharing with the audience. We appreciate you. And
Okay.
that's it, we're out.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Anna. Such a pleasure to just get to chat with your audience today. Much love, and thank you so much.
All right, see you in the next episode. Bye.